Autre radio, autre culture, bonjour. Audio People et autres radios, autre culture vous présentent les deuxièmes rencontres de la création sonore qui se sont déroulées au SAE Institute de Paris les 26 et 27 mai 2010. Bonne écoute.
A little bit of work after a day.
It's probably worth pointing out that, I mean, that's, what, 2 days?
Yeah.
Well, it was two days. Yeah.
2 days,
yeah.
to get to that. So I think it's quite an achievement, actually.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I think it's time for question and answers.
Yeah, sure.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
So I think I will pass the microphone to the first.
Just while we're waiting for the first question, if I could just do one to Jeff.
Right.
Obviously doing it through the gear or most of the equipment that was used for the first sessions.
Yes.
Would you agree that probably the real positive side of the exercise 40 years later was the fact that they actually had to work under the same conditions
and
sort of making them work together to actually create a sound in the studio rather than relying on the fact that, we can do lots of multi-tracks, we can fly in this there and just build up a hodgepodge?
No, it's a question of making decisions at the time of recording and not do it on the mix. I mean, that's the way it had to be, and it was hard work. It was work as we know it, making a record, you know?
I was just wondering, with all your experience, piling up over the years, were you able to actually, I know the cover bands don't have the same swagger as the Beatles, but were you able to, technically or personally, you think some of the remakes came out better than the originals? Or?
Are we talking about the Beatles remasters?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
about. No, well, I mean, I was not involved with the Beatles remastering, right?
No, I'm talking about, you were recording the Beatles
yes.
at the time, right?
He's talking about Sgt. Pepper.
Oh, right.
The cover bands for Sgt. Pepper. Yeah.
So say again.
Your experience, you had more experience over time, right?
Yes.
With all that equipment. And your techniques were better, you had more skills.
Right.
And I mean, disregarding the fact that they don't have the same swagger as the Beatles have.
Right.
They're just not maybe as good, they're not the same band.
Yes.
Did technically some of the songs come out better when you remade them?
The Frey doing Fixing a Hole was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd say the phrase "fixing a hole" was good. Yeah,
you think it was better than the original. Or?
Well, I mean, the original's always
not
got
better.
Some magic. Yeah, I know. But I think the phrase. Because none of this was issued, it was going to be issued on record. But the phrase version of "fixing a hole" was really good. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Right, I won't need it.
Monsieur Reguilon.
When you were at ADT, how did you synchronise the two machines?
We didn't have to. We're doing a mix from 4 tracks, or 8 track, right? And the vocal's on track one. So we lift off the vocal from track one from the sync amp. So it's ahead of the replay head. Goes into a stereo machine, which is on vary speed, which means slight, depending on which machine it is, the head gaps on the stereo machine. So it's going to be ahead, the vocal in theory is going to be ahead of the vocal for the remix, so we can retard it or advance it. And, you know, we used to have a sweep oscillator, which made it a lot easier to control it. And now with vernier scales, because Richard, my assistant, was just superb at that. But with vernier scales now, I mean, it's really tricky. But when we did flanging on, Harrison's guitar, we used to call it flanging. Richard used to, get the sweep oscillator and do that with it, which made the tape machine sort of wobble. So there's a little bit of pitch change as on the double copy of Harrison's guitar. And often, you know, John would be sitting there maybe, and he knew that Richard and I used to sometimes overdo it, and John would give us a sort of a smile, you know, and George would look up thinking, it doesn't sound quite right, but we used to sometimes overdo it. It was a beautiful sound, you know, because it was at the time just incredible. It was sort of on everything. And it was only because both John and Paul were great at double tracking vocals. But John got lazy and said, well, isn't there a machine that can do this to save me the time in going down to the studio to double track my vocal? So that's how that really all came about.
Doris.
Yeah.
And who was it that leant on the edge of the reel to create your flanging?
John Lennon created that.
I don't know. Or
yeah, because he could touch the spool and it used to go. I can't remember that. Yeah, that's what he did.
I'm also pleased that see you've moved on from the white coats that you.
Well, we never Dave, you had a white coat.
No, I didn't have.
No, we didn't have white coats because we had suits and ties. Yeah.
Well, it was an Abbey Road. The technical engineers up until the time asked, modernists came in because they were basically cutting engineers originally with 78s and weights and all that in the control room, and that they were like technicians, so they used to wear white lab coats, and still a lot of the technical guys wore the white lab coats, and they were technical engineers. We used to put the mics out, line the machines up, we did all the work, and then Jeff came in, put the fader up and got all the glory. But it's a joke, honest, Jeff. But we used to wear the white coats, and then the guys that set the orchestras out and put the mic stands and the organs and other pianos ready and all that, and brown coats. Yeah. They were brown coats, and we were white coats, but I didn't wear a white coat. I wore a beer-stained T-shirt.
Now, the reason for that dress code, and we had to wear suits and ties, was, you know, we were also, as assistant engineers, working on classical albums with Maria Callas or Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, and you had to be, you know, well-dressed and your shoes polished, and, you know, that's where that sort of started from, you know. It was respect for the artist, you know.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
How close to the original Beatles sound do you think you got?
Oh, fairly close. If we'd had more time, no, very close, in fact. I mean, there's different energy from those bands, but the sounds and stuff were basically there. If they were fine-tuned, it would, I mean, sound-wise, it was pretty close. It really was.
So eventually no piece of equipment had lost its own character?
No, not at all. The only thing I had to do, they had a curve, what we used to call a curve bender, which came out of the mastering room. Abbey Road, you weren't allowed to use that on recording sessions. It was quite an intricate piece of equalization equipment, but it was never allowed to be in the control room, and sometimes we snuck it down to do things on, but I didn't have one of those at British Grove, and I used George Massenberg's equalizer, which was the nearest thing I could get to it, and the 1176 is the nearest I can get to the Altec, and the mono Fairchilds we did have, because the stereo Fairchilds don't sound the same as the mono Fairchilds.
And do you prefer the analog mix to the digital one? I guess you had both of them?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. No, there was an instance when I did something just before Christmas, you know, where we did a mix, you know, to Pro Tools and half-inch 30-ips, half-inch tape, and went to the mastering room, and both it was like chalk and cheese. I mean, they were two different records. It's still quite amazing when you do that comparison. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
How many people in the room still work analog regularly?
Joanne.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
No, great, yeah.
Very good. Do you prefer it, or is it just you've got it and you haven't got digital, or what? It's interesting to know, isn't it?
Yeah, this is something at British Grove, which is very important, because you have the two types of tape machines. Yeah. I think British Grove handle the best of both technologies.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And we shouldn't be, you know, entirely analog or entirely digital, but try to find out the best and to have the tools which are the most transparent. Because a good equipment is an equipment that you don't really feel. You don't. No. Okay, so I'd like to. Do you have other questions?
I would like to know which cutting machine was used. Neumann? For vinyl.
On Sgt. Pepper?
On the original?
Yes. On Scully.
Scully?
Yes, and it would have been an Autophon head, I guess.
And for the vinyl cut?
Yeah,
it was a Scully?
Yeah, on the original Sgt. Pepper album was a Scully.
And head was Scully too, West Rex, Autophon? Cutting head.
Yeah, I think we had Autophon heads. I don't think we had Westrex, did we, at EMI? No, they were all Autophons. Autophon. Yes.
Was that stereo you're talking about on mono?
You also said monitoring was done only by speakers, never by phones, by headphones?
No. Just
always
loudspeaker.
Always mono, one loudspeaker.
Uh-huh. After management left at night, because the manager sometimes came into the control, we used to switch it to two loudspeakers just to, you know, to get a better vibe. But when we were actually recording it for real, we never went to two speakers, even if it was in the evening.
But what were the heads then? We used to actually wind our own points for the cutting heads.
Well, Kibbe did.
Oui.
Donc j'ai lu dans un livre qui s'appelait Recording the Beatles que les voix des Beatles étaient enregistrées sans casque au début. Et je voudrais savoir comment...
He read in the history of the recording of the Beatles that they were singing without headphones. They were recording without headphones.
Oh yeah, yes.
Je voudrais savoir comment se passaient les séances et si c'était mieux ou moins bien.
For vocal overdubs, we used to have two slim. We're talking about in the recording studio, two slim Vox speakers to send the pre-recorded track, and that was the fallback. That was before that we used headphones, and before that we used to. There was an RLS 10. Which was a big speaker. I've forgotten who made the RLS.
Telefunken
RLS-10, which we used for foldback. But then we realised there was too much, you know, power in it, and the slim Vox speakers were more directional. But that's what we used for foldback for overdubbing. Yes.
Also, we used to use a 48. KM 48 microphone, which you could switch to figure of eight, and you could have John on one side, Paul on the other side, and then the dead side faced the speaker, which had the foldback on it.
Right. And when we were getting into more intricate recordings, we really needed ultra sort of separation and things. That's when we then it was decided to use headphones for the first time. I mean, the Beatles were the first people, I believe, to use headphones for overdubbing at EMI Studios.
Did you find the results better without headphones or with headphones?
Oh, I mean, for the results we were after, obviously headphones. But okay, yeah, really headphones, yes. It got so intricate the way we were trying to work.
Yeah.
We had to have headphones.
I have a question for all of you because, you know, there's a lot of money involved in all of these things, getting the analog equipment and everything, the studio. Don't you think it's a bit frustrating nowadays to put so much energy in doing the best thing possible when you know that a lot of people, you know, just listen to music with MP3s nowadays?
Yes.
Yes is the short answer to that.
Yeah.
I think everybody hopes that we move to a higher definition codec as soon as we can. I mean, obviously, it's in the first instance, it's limited by available bandwidth. You can't spend a day downloading a track for your MP3, and I'm sure that's what led. File size was what led that, but it's not. They're not great to listen to. I know he's not here, but George Massenberg conducted a fantastic test in London about 2 months ago when he demonstrated the difference between the source material recorded at whatever 96 or 192, and once it'd been rendered as an MP3, and he clearly demonstrated the artifacts that you get in the process of creating an MP3, and when you hear that, it's a startling demonstration of what actually these artifacts consist of. So anything that moves us ahead of that is got to be, you know, come sooner rather than later, let's hope.
No, I mean, I'm just, you know, hopeful that, you know, we may eventually have another format, even if it be an analogue.
Do you actually think that people would go back to analogue?
Yeah. I mean, in America, I mean, most top bands still put out their albums in vinyl as well as the other stuff. But there's quite a following, certainly in America, for vinyl. Yeah. But the other problem is if people do their mix on Pro, what is happening, they do their mix into Pro Tools instead of going to half-inch 30-ips and a Pro Tools mix, and they cut their Pro Tools mix onto vinyl, it doesn't sound right, it doesn't sound good. You need to have it coming from the half inch to get the depth. Mm. But I'm hopeful that there will be a resurgence to be able to educate.
I'm hopeful too. Yeah.
Well, no, to educate people. We could have another seminar on this. But I mean, it's the education in schools of musical appreciation and really what the kids are missing within tonality of music and musical instruments. So once they're aware of that, you know, I mean, that's what brought me when I was like 6 or 7 years old into the business. You know, I mean, purely that was musical, you know, appreciation. You know. And we have to bring that back.
You can get high quality audio because, I mean, I know some stuff has been issued 192, 24 bits on Blu-ray, audio only, which people should do more of. And you can get high quality downloads from Lynn and Name and people like that, very high quality downloads if you wish. But it's very limited and people are so used to the convenience of an MP3 putting in your phone. And a whole couple of generations of people are used to listening to that terrible sound, and it's a great shame because, you know, you've probably now got the when, you know, like Jeff was saying, in the old days we used to try and get the sound as good as we could, but we were always limited by the equipment and the end result and the release format. But now we're not. We've got the release format that can give you just about anything you want, and when nobody's using it, and you've got the equipment that can record anything as good as you want if you're prepared to spend the money and the time to do it. But nobody does it because it's not cheap. And that is just a crying shame, because I remember in the days when we used to get records over at Abbey Road, we used to wonder how they got the sound, didn't they?
Yeah.
Places like, what was it, Motown, the Motown discs.
That's right.
And a lot of it, I found out since, a lot of it is the way they play, and the second bit is that they used to cut their singles at half speed. We never knew that.
Yeah, when you talk about the vinyl records, the last Mark Knopfler album has been produced in both formats. You have the DVD, because there is a DVD bonus, you have the CD audio, and you have also an analog record. Actually, it's two analog records, because and that is sold in a beautiful box, which cost quite a lot of money, £89 something. And I was really surprised to see how much they sold. Oh, I mean, they sold a lot.
Yeah.
And personally, here on this floor, I know somebody who bought already four, because he bought one for his father for his birthday, one for himself, and then for friends, you know. So I think so. I don't know. Maybe you can answer to that question. Did Chuck do two separate mixes for this?
No. He didn't
Chuck
do two
Lace,
separate
the sound
mixes,
engineer.
As far as I'm aware. What he did was he. The mastering engineer, Bob Ludwig, actually did two cuts, two sessions, one specifically for vinyl, one specifically for the CD. But just another interesting point that occurs to me in all of that, we had the opportunity to compare a new vinyl cut of, I think it was the first Dire Straits album, with the CD. And we had them both up in the studio, and we were looking at them, and we run a spectrum analyzer in the studio as a matter of course, and we were astonished to see energy coming off the vinyl record up at 30 to 40 K, and it was a big surprise to see that. We'd never realized that was what you got off a record. Dave has a lot of things to say about people you're not supposed to be able to hear above 10 K or 12 K, or if you're very young you might hear a bit higher than that, but energy at between 30 and 40 K has a profound influence on the fundamentals further down, and it was a very illuminating exercise. Vinyl, there's nothing above the CD above, what is it?
20
above
K.
Above 20 K. So it's a black brick wall filter, yeah. And really accounts, it was a graphic demonstration of the difference between a CD and a vinyl record. And believe me, there is one.
We've got equipment that's got differences at 45, 50 K, analog equipment that we've been listening to. And the differences are well above the 20 K, and you can hear the difference quite plainly.
You can prove this. You just play a sine wave at 15 K within hearing range of people of a certain age. Play a sine wave and play a square wave. You can hear the difference.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Exactly.
Yeah.
But potentially a CD should have better bass than a vinyl record.
Yeah. Beyond this frequency issue, if you had to pick up two or three things analog is better at rather than digital, what would you choose? Is it space? Is it depth? Is it... If you had to quote two or three qualities that analog has better than digital, what would you choose?
It depends which digital format you're talking about. If you're talking 192...
Between CD and vinyl.
192, 24 bits, I'd choose the 192. I'm not a great fan of vinyl, so don't ask me. It's an unfair question.
Really? No, I mean, to me, if I'm listening to something on vinyl, that's something you can't really say what it is, but there's like more heart and soul in the music. It's more... There's a coloration, there's a depth there. And the only thing that I know... from working on film work with digital and Pro Tools, it's just superb for film work, because you sort of don't get that sort of colouring of the cloudiness underneath everything. Everything's so spot on, especially if you're mixing like 160 tracks on a film dub, and you've got the sound effects, the music, the dialogue. But Pro Tools and digital is just so superb for film work. I mean, you can't really use analog for film work and get the same impact. But of course, the reverse it is for me with recorded music, for just listening to the music, and that's where vinyl sort of shines for me. Yeah.
I don't need that thing. Go and listen to Blade Runner. I'd counter your argument. Well, it was all analog. It was all 35mm transports and.
Right. Oh no, I know, but I mean, I'm talking about in general, you know, because it's because of the way, you know, the complexity of the scores now and the dialogue. Oh, absolutely, because it's so much going on. In fact, in some cases, you know, too much. No, I couldn't agree more than what you're saying with things like that. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But a CD is accurate. What, one in 700,000? A standard CD must be accurate to 1 in 700,000. There's no way a needle in a groove can be that accurate.
Don't you miss wound flutter?
Yeah.
Well, sort of just move along a little bit, or maybe even wrap up, Jeff. What sort of percentage would you say you use in your current method of working that's based on, shall we say, your previous years at Abbey Road and maybe the period afterwards?
It depends on the project. I still would go for analog, because if I work at, like, for instance, Capitol Studios in Los Angeles, it's so easy to link 324s together. But if I'm sort of running out of tracks, it's much faster to just overdub the harmonies to Pro Tools and fly it back in. But it comes very easy to me to work on 324s running in lock, you know. And the guys down at the Capitol, you know, the maintenance people, you know, like Dave and stuff. The maintenance people at Capitol are very, very good with analog, yeah.
You can get, I mean, you know, from our ATRs, the half-inch machines, you can get flat up to about 40K than an analog tape machine, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, if I was, you know, pre rehearsing outside of the studio and you know, and I was recording, I'd go back into British Grove or anywhere really, but to British Grove because of the facility it is, to go onto an 8-track 2-inch. And I believe that 8-track 2-inch has a SMPTE code on the bottom, so
yes, it does.
So you could run that in lock with another analog machine or so. But for the basic rhythm recording, a 2-inch 8-track would be great, because you know our original rhythm tracks on Beatles stuff was a 1-inch 4-track, so you know that's why the noise level was so low. Because I've never been using Dolbys or anything.
Yeah, you've got a, you know, as good a noise floor as digital, and you've got twice the frequency response on those machines. Or the analog machines are fantastic, and that's why you can hear the difference. Yeah. I'm not so sure on a vinyl.
So some of the tracks on Pepper, some of the more complicated, we did 4-track to 4-track to 4-track, and so it's a third generation, but there's still no Dolbys and there's no real apparent hiss.
And do you still have the musicians play together as much as possible, at least for the basic rhythm tracks?
Even
the whole production as much as possible?
Absolutely. I can't work. I mean, the way I was brought up was, you know, I was working with real artists with real talent, and I wasn't working with manufactured talent, and I can't do that. So it all starts on the studio floor, and it goes from there.
Are there any current projects that have just been released, or projects that are coming down the pipes that people should look out for?
No, not really, because I've gone off in a different direction, because I'm producing, you know, the Cheap Trick Sergeant Pepper in Las Vegas, which opens on June the 10th, and we're working on another musical at the end of the year in Los Angeles based on Beatles. But so there's no sort of recorded projects. I mean, the hardest one I've just finished was Paul's City Fields concert, which was live, but that's a long story which I'm not going to go into. But and my I would just say a little thing on that. What I was presented with the recording of that, and it had to be done in such a rush. I think I had like 33 songs to mix in 2.5 days or something, and I just went for the really good points of the recording, which was Paul's voice, the bass, and the drums, and they were just mixed up front. And the guitars were sunk back, and there wasn't a lot of ambience. But it sounds quite exciting, because that was the exciting content of the performance. So that's how I had to do it very fast. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of excerpts on YouTube for that.
No, and in fact, I didn't even. I didn't have. Did, no.
The Paul McCartney live thing.
Right, I didn't even have time to play back my mixes. I just wanted to get into a thing. It felt good doing the mix. It just felt good at the time, and I went on to the next title. Had I listened to the mix, I would have made some changes possibly, and I didn't want to be put in that position.
Il y a une question qui me turlupine et que j'ai jamais pu lire nulle part. Est-ce que les Beatles ont enregistré aussi avec un clic ?
Not that I remember.
No.
No. Thank you. Maybe you know Paul McCartney on his solo work, but it's not the Beatles. Yeah. No.
Broad Street, you've had a click track.
Yeah. French has improved. If there was one of the toys of modernity that you would have been able to choose in your original days, automation. You did it as you did it, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the automation. I mean, what I used to like by not using automation was the fact that you used to choreograph the mix. And the adrenaline rush when you did one of those mixes was just incredible, and it was like a performance. Mm. And then when we started to get the automation, you know, it just became a very linear sort of mix with no life. No, I mean, and I know on one of Paul's albums, Tug of War, and I think some of the songs were on 424 tracks, and we've been making slave tapes up, and we came back to the original tapes, and we had to get even another mixing console. And it wasn't every song that we did this on, but there was one song it took 2 weeks to choreograph the mix to. It was just me and my assistant, because we had to work out all the moves on the harmonies and all the EQ changes and so forth. But I used to love that. And then someone might lift up the guitar too loud and think, "Wow, it's great," you know. But it was a performance. The mix was a performance. Now it's just boring, you know. But normally when I'm mixing now, I mean, I still do that. And if it's like just a little thing, I might just put it into automation to lift one thing up. But I still don't mix like that with automation. Yeah.
But what tool would you use?
There's no tools that I'd grasp today. I don't think that I'd want, to be honest with you. Not unless you could tell me one that I might like.
I'm lucky enough. Your mixes bring me to my knees, so thank you for that.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. And the new stuff is what it is, you know. Something you just said, the education. We listen to FM radio that's Auburn compressed. We buy MP3 tracks. There is a saving grace, but not very accessible in so much you can get 24-bit 192, and it's just not very accessible.
No.
And you're recording to 40K on analog. With all my best respects to somebody recording at 48K on Pro Tools or whatever, aliasing chops you off at 22K if you're lucky.
Yeah, exactly. What about speakers, Jeff? What sort of speakers do you like to work on when you're recording mixing?
I use JBL speakers. The only reason for that was the fact that when I've done a mix, that first of all they've been doing a lot of pop records. There's a lot of punch in them. But the great thing about those speakers for me was when I was to take the mix into the mastering room or take it outside of the place where I'd mixed it, the relationship between the voice and the music track was spot on. There wasn't too much voice or too little voice. The relationship was so good. But if I go on, if we go into a situation whereby I'm not able to have those speakers, I just go with whatever the studio has. And if I'm mixing, I might use a couple of little Yamahas or something. But I just like to accept what a studio offers, and it gives it its own identity. Otherwise, everything starts sounding the same again, you know.
So the different speakers could make your mix sound different.
The Zombies
was really, really good fun and very fast. You know, I mean, it was great, you know. I know.
Well, I think we're going to have a round of applause.
Oh, really?
No? Jeff va se mettre à l'entrée à une petite table. Si vous avez donc les bouquins à faire signer, il est tout à fait ouvert pour une petite séance de signature de livres, pochette de disques si vous les avez apportés. Voilà. Et on va se retrouver à 4h pour le studio. C'était mieux avant.
Autre radio, autre culture.